Thanks. I'm Lauren. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Laura.
And I'd like to thank you guys for having me back. I was here last year and really enjoyed getting to know some of you. So I see some familiar faces, which is always good. I'd like to thank Billy for asking me to. I'm wearing his watch now because I can't manage to bring my own timepiece. So anyway, it was great to be here with you guys. It is always an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything in AA. You know, and I usually say that most of the time when I speak, and then I usually follow it up with, I did not always feel that way. I used to get asked to do a lot of things in AA that I didn't want to do, and I showed up only because that was the way I was sponsored. You show up when you're asked to do something. You be kind and courteous. You pay back the gift that you have been given. And then, as a result of doing that again and again and again, it started to melt away a little bit of the selfishness inside of me, and I started to have real joy in being here and being with you guys. And that took a long time for me. I'm very selfish. I still am, but God really has transformed me in a lot of different ways and made me into a useful person. And I believe that that is the purpose of AA. I get to be transformed, and I get a relationship with a creator of my understanding. And as a result of that, I become useful to my fellows in and outside of AA. And I'm eternally grateful for that because I've never been very useful. My sobriety date is May 23rd of 2000. I live just outside of Richmond, just north, about 15 miles in Ashland, Virginia. That's where I grew up, and that's where I live now. And it's pretty ironic because I spent most of my childhood feeling very outside, wishing that I didn't live in this small town where everybody knew me, and that I think I was adopted, and because I just felt so different from my family and so discontent with living life the way they were living it. And they are very good people, and they live a very, I think, well-balanced life that makes sense to them. But I was looking for some excitement, and Ashland did not have it. So I was deeply disappointed that, you know, that the life that I got brought to was the life of, you know, being of service in your community, being a part of a faith community, going to a job on a regular basis, being home at night with your family. That was not exciting to me. And I hear a lot of people talk about in AA, or some of us, not all of us, grew up in alcoholic homes where it's a little more exciting and you're out late at night and you get to do whatever you want to do and there are no rules, and that was not my experience. And there were lots of rules, and I'm an only child, so there were even more rules. And I was scared for a long time because I didn't want people to know what I was thinking or the fact that I didn't like my surroundings or that I didn't feel like I fit in. And so I was constantly doing things that I thought only I did, but I come to find out most of us do those here, which is putting on the different faces, the different masks, you know. Showing up over here is this person, showing up over here is this person. And it's exhausting, and you can forget who you are sometimes. And I'm like, oh, I'm showing up to church hungover, still reeking of alcohol and lying. I had to do a lot of lying to present this good girl, but yet be a hardcore drinker in a very small town. I didn't start drinking until I was 17. I was a late bloomer by many standards in AA. But a lot of that just came from, you know, I was in a pretty, my parents didn't drink really. They're what you would consider, I guess, I don't even know if they're social drinkers. My dad has a beer like maybe once a week. When I was growing up, I don't remember seeing that a lot. You know, they didn't hang out with people who drank a lot, so I just really wasn't exposed to that. And I tried for a really long time to be a good girl. I really did. I wanted that life to make sense to me, and it just didn't. I was just constantly restless and irritable, and you know, trying all these things, and tried to be smart, tried to be athletic, tried to be comedian. I was pretty good at that, making you laugh, especially at the expense of others. I had the skill of that, you know, which doesn't win you many friends, in a way. And my mom used to constantly tell me, she's like, do you realize the way you treat people hurts people? And you alienate others. And I just kind of, like many things, brush that off. You don't know what you're talking about. You know, I'm funny and people like funny people. And that's all I had identified with thus far. So I start drinking. Well, let me back up for a minute. In later high school, I started to get, I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I started to get a little funky, a little depressed. Started to try to manage my life and those around me, and started to turn inward a lot more with my just not fitting in. And that resulted in depression, which will happen to me today. If I start thinking about myself a lot and turn inward, I get funky and depressed and start feeling like I don't fit in and you people don't like me and I've got to become something else to be okay with you and with me. So that was going on, and I met alcohol, and for me, alcohol was a spiritual awakening, like what AA offers. I felt comfortable in my own skin. I felt at peace with you. I felt present. I had never really been present before because I was constantly thinking, like, oh, I said that really stupid thing last week, and now I'm with these people again, and they're thinking that I'm stupid. Oh, I'm worried about next week because how am I going to handle this situation? Or just either in the future or in the past. And when I drank, I was right here with you guys. We were having a good time. What happened last week didn't matter. That test that I was going to fail tomorrow didn't matter. You know, things like that. And it was my junior prom, and I had a blast. It was just absolutely fantastic. We drank foo-foo drinks, little daiquiris, and they tasted good. They went down fast, and I felt wonderful. And I wanted to know if everyone else was feeling this way, so I started announcing this and asking questions and checking in to make sure that everyone was having as good a time as me. And it was just, it was great. I don't think I actually got sick that night. Most of my drinking escapades result in me getting sick. I don't have a built-in indicator that says you're drinking a little too much, you're going to start getting dizzy and throw up soon. So I drank that night. I had consequences right away, you know, hooking up with boys I shouldn't be hooking up with, hurting dear friends of mine, and thinking that drinking makes me a rock star and this cool guy in my school thinks I'm attractive now. And I related that all to relaxing, being comfortable in my own skin, and tapping into this new way of life. So I pursued that with a full-out, you know, drinking every chance I can get. So for me, what that looked like was not 7 days a week, was not sipping beer before school when I go in. It was not skipping school. I still had a lot of fear about presenting this good girl because people need to know that I'm a good girl so I don't get in trouble. I didn't want any consequences for my new life I was discovering. And I drank on the weekends. I was, you know, from the beginning, I just drank really hard. I blacked out some, I think, in high school, even though I didn't know that was blacking out. But I look back now and not remembering but still being awake is a blackout, so I think that was going on. Just started running with the crowd that was doing that and having what I thought was the best time of my life. I thought I had finally found where I fit in. Started to become more comfortable with who I was. It's like this new identity I'd put on. And I started to slip more and more into that and become less and less concerned about what other people thought about me. And you know, and continued to have consequences, really. I just was on, you know, a really fast road for a long time and stepped on people's toes to get what I wanted. I love how they talk about in the Big Book, you know, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate, and we don't even know why. It's like, oh, where did that come from? They hate me, you know. Oh, I kissed their boyfriend last night at the party. Wonder why. You know, stuff like that. Or I know. I don't know if you guys did that, but I did that. And a lot of that stuff was done in a blackout, and I didn't even know why people wouldn't talk to me the next day. So that behavior got enhanced by doing a lot of enhancers during college. I went off to school. I graduated that year. I was still 17, which made it very difficult to get into bars because you at least have to be 18 to get in the door. So I was running around, you know, hijacking IDs and had all these little schemes of, I was telling someone this recently, probably shouldn't have been telling them this, but it's like, yeah, we used to take alcohol and rub the X's off our hands, and then you, you know, slap your hands together with someone who had the right ID for you to get in, the little stamp. And my covert drinking schemes of putting shots in the bathroom so then I can go in and take the shot. Because I had most of my drinking was done underage, so you have to get very creative. We would drink a lot before we went out. My roommate and I, she was a lot of fun. She was a wild woman, too. She could hang with the guys, which I always admired. Because I would always get sick. So you have to learn to compensate. I became a good puker. I would puke and then continue to drink. And she used to comment on that. She's like, that's great. You didn't throw up on your shoes or clothes tonight. That's awesome. So we can keep going and we don't have to go home for you to change. You're like, yeah. So, you know, we did a lot of that stuff. We did a lot of running around. And what was very interesting is we both came to school with very good intentions. I'm gonna party on the weekends like I did in high school. I'm going to study and get good grades. My parents have put a lot of energy and resources into me going to school. They did not have that when they grew up. And it was very important to them. And these great intentions I have last a few weeks. And then I'm, you know, the weekend is not quite enough time to party. And really, people are going out on Thursday nights. And then, really, people are going out on Wednesday nights, too. And then that's extended through Sunday. So Monday nights were the nights that I picked not to drink. And I did that for a while and started to pursue those people that drink like me. If you didn't drink like me, then I did not hang out with you. And as a result, a lot of people that I was friends with in high school, you know, I just started like, oh, don't have time to go out with you, that type of thing. I alienated a lot of people, and they didn't know why. It just kind of dropped off the face of the planet in a lot of social scenes. Probably 2 years into school, my ability to maintain a B, C's, you know, C's weren't great, but, you know, we'd take this, and drink and party was becoming more and more difficult to achieve. I started getting, you know, D's and F's. I wasn't able to show up to class. I was showing up under the influence. I remember once I had this class, and I think I went maybe twice. And it's the final exam, and I decide I'm a little nervous, so I better drink a couple 40s before I go in to relax me. So that'll help maybe some of that information that I retained in those two classes will come out on the paper. And just started really living my life curtailed to drinking. Just continued to step on the toes. The depression showed up again, which I thought was a result of, you know, the boys I was dating. Because, you know, nothing really against them, but they partied like I did. And our capacity to show up and be real, you know, partners to each other was not really there. We were drinking buddies. That was about it. And people that live like I do are not usually very faithful. And I was one of those. I was not very faithful, and neither were they. And I thought that that was a result. I thought that that showed up in me being depressed. But what really was I was turning more and more inward again. I had found this temporary solution to a problem I had long before I started drinking, which was a spiritual malady. I truly believe that I was one of those people that had untreated alcoholism or whatever you want to call it before I ever drank. I was so spiritually sick, always looking outside of myself to feel better, always looking for you to tell me that I'm okay. I can't figure that out for myself. I'm too lazy to figure out what I believe. I just mock what you believe, which is what I started to do to the church. I thought these people are rigid and just unworldly and ignorant. You know, never mind the fact they had lives that made sense to them, and I'm out here running around like a wild woman and can't figure out why I can't have a serious relationship with anyone. I can't fit in my own skin. I'm starting to be depressed. I can't show up to class. I can't hold down a job. I can't have relationships with women. You know, my friendships were a disaster most of the time. I usually had one woman I hung with, and she partied like I did. I felt girls were, I didn't like them very much. They were either competition or they did not party like I did, so they were a little sissy, or they were concerned with things that I was not concerned with, and had a really hard time connecting there, as with most people. Just really, you know, when I look back, it was like I had trouble connecting with anyone. I used to, this sounds insane, but this is what I used to do. I used to, if you're familiar with Rage Against the Machine, I used to listen to that song, and it's a cuss word in it, so I won't say, but, you know, it's like, basically this, like, you can't tell me how to live my life, I'm going to do what I want to do. I used to listen to that on the way home from college, so that when I showed up, I would be fully prepared to defend the way I was living and do what I wanted to do at the expense of my family. And just really antisocial. I started piercing my nose and have, like, you know, many, many holes in my ear, and just really dressing antisocial, you know, it was like all kinds of things, and or just outside the mainstream. And I'm not saying you got to be mainstream to be an AA or any of that mess, but for me, I was just putting on this show to push you away from me because I didn't want you to get too close to me because I didn't know how to deal with that. And I dropped out of school eventually because I mentioned to my parents that I was kind of floating. I had changed my major like 12 different times and didn't know what I wanted to do. And that's the reason I needed to take some time off, figure out what I wanted to do, who I wanted to be when I grow up. But what was really happening was what I mentioned earlier, is I couldn't show up and perform the level that I had been performing, living the way that I had started to live. The alcohol and the alcohol enhancers were much more important than anything else or anybody else in my life. And they were like, you only have a year left. Just pick a major and graduate. I'm like, no, I'm not going to sell out. That's what I told them. So funny. I know, because I think here I am, I'm not this sellout to the man and society, and I'm not going to go work in corporate America. But I was such a slave, you know, and just such a hypocrite. It's so ironic now. I'm sure they were looking at me like, what's wrong with her? So anyway, I drop out of school, living up in Blacksburg and doing my thing, waiting tables. I worked at I found this restaurant that would tolerate my bad behavior. They were very loving and very tolerant of kids that were trying to grow up, basically. And they used to tell me, they were like, you know, when you're good, Laura, you're probably one of the best employees we have. And when you're bad, you are the worst. Because I would show up, you know, haven't gone to sleep, same clothes as wearing the day before, obviously not in the right straight frame of mind, sick, grouchy, and I wait at tables, so you know, you do try to be nice to people, in theory. You know, so it's like I lived like that, doing that, and started drinking almost every afternoon, and sometimes I talk about my little dog. I think I'll talk about him tonight. He's big now. He weighs almost 100 pounds. I got this little dog over the summer because I needed some company, but mind you, I am never home. So that's in my head. So I get this little dog. He's like this big, very cute and sweet. And I have to go to work and open, I think it's 6 or 6:30. So I chain him up every morning at the thing, you know, to the whatever pole in our yard. And I leave and I put it to food and water and I go off and go to work. And sometimes I come home at the end of my shift and sometimes I don't. And he's less than 3 months old. And now, if you know puppies, they knock over their water about 5 seconds after you leave, and then they run around the pole. And I would find him at like 3 o'clock in the morning like that. And I did this day after day after day after day after day to him. And I'm a huge animal lover. It's not the type of life I want to lead. That's not how I want to treat anything, especially a little innocent dog. And I think I'm doing all right. I mean, he used to use the bathroom in the house, and I would come home drunk and couldn't clean up after him, you know. I'm just like, oh, I'll do that tomorrow. You know, it was just this, I was living in this this life that was embarrassing. If I would not let people come over to my apartment. And my roommate, who was gone for the summer, we got this new place together. You know, I had to quickly get my act together by the time she came back and, you know, clean out her bedroom because that's where the dog is using the bathroom. Oh, that's not funny, but anyway. So you know, so once again, I'm going to clean up real good for her because I care about what she thinks about me. You know, I love her dearly. She does not party like I do. She likes to hang, but she's not like me. And she works and pays for school. So I'm able to go do my thing while she's being responsible. Anyway, my little dog has to go live with my parents because I obviously cannot take care of him. So once again, you know, signing up for responsibility, unable to meet it, and do a pathetic job of it, you know, is very, you know, to me, those were big deals. But I would just... Oh, well, it's just because I have to work two jobs, you know. You know, there are plenty of people who work two jobs and are responsible. I just wasn't one of them. So living like that takes its toll on me emotionally and mentally, and I decide that I can't live like that and decide that, you know, geographical cure, go home, get some structure, live with my parents, take care of my dog, who's now like 85 pounds and a complete maniac because he's been undisciplined. It's crazy. He's very well behaved now, if any of you meet him. And so I do that, and with great intentions, once again, I'm going to get a job, I'm going to shape up, I'm going to quit doing all this other stuff, I'm going to drink socially, and I'm going to take care of my dog. Those are my goals. I mean, they're not too high. They're not like get out on my own or anything like that. It's I'm going to go home and clean up and get straight. And so I managed to do that for like a month. Not even a month. I started drinking probably 2 or 3 weeks into that after work. And pretty soon it's, you know, 5 a.m. I'm calling my parents, telling them I'm not coming home. They are once again taking over my responsibilities, which are, one, taking care of the dog. And that's about it. So they're doing that for me. And I decide that working is very inconvenient. I save up a couple $100s. I've met some kids that live exactly how I want to live, which is they work when they need to, and then they party the rest of the time. So I took my dog and my car and a bag. I quit my job, and I went to live with them in the city. So I lived out of my car on people's couches. I didn't actually have to sleep in my car, really. People would let me sleep on their couches. And managed to land myself with this guy who had this, we came up with this great idea of going on the road with a band, which was fabulous, I thought. Life of freedom. I was going to sell products while we were there. Some of them legal. Bottled water, cigarettes, and chips. And because we saw people, and there are people that make money doing that, but they don't smoke all the cigarettes, drink all the water, and eat all the chips. Which is what I did. He's like, you gotta quit smoking. The cigarettes we're supposed to be selling. And I'm like, wow, I gotta smoke cigarettes. So he was not a drinker. He drank maybe one Corona, and I didn't like Corona, so I didn't think that was very... just didn't admire his drinking. And he put up with me for about 3 months of us being on the road, and it was a really great experience for me, because when I had a really hard time when I came to the book identifying myself as an alcoholic. I know that sounds strange, but I did. Because I could stop drinking for days, weeks. I mean, one time I quit for 3 months because I had a stomach ulcer due to stress, not bourbon. And I thought, well, because I can stop drinking, that means I'm not an alcoholic. And my sponsor, when I actually got one, took me through the book, and we got to spend a lot of time in the first step in looking at what alcoholism is and isn't. And I got a lot of those old beliefs, old ideas, you know, just some crazy stuff I had made up, you know, kind of poof, vanish. Alcoholism is not how much you drink, how often you drink. It is what happens when alcohol enters your body. does it set off an allergy in you? And can you stay stopped? No one had ever asked me that before, because I was so proud in my 3 weeks or 30 days or 3 months or, you know, whatever. And I said, no, I can't stay stopped. I will drink again. And that was a great time. When I was on the road with him, we didn't drink every day. But whenever I started to drink, it became the most important thing, and I pursued it with a passion. And I remember one night in particular, we're in this town. I don't even know where we were. I didn't know anybody. And we're hanging out in the parking lot with these guys that play professional hockey, which I thought was fabulous. And they were all very cute. And Nesta, my dog, he always pops up in the story. He could go to Aladog, but they don't have that. And he runs off, you know, because I, of course, don't pay attention to him, down the street. So this guy I'm with goes off to look for him. And the professional hockey players suggest that maybe we should go out to bars and they'll buy all my drinks for the evening. And I think that's a fabulous idea. So I just leave with them while he's off looking for my dog, mind you. And, you know, a couple hours later, he finds me at some bar, you know. And it was always like that. I mean, you can imagine he was sick and tired of me and ready to be done with me after the end of 3 months. Our business agreement was up and, you know, anyway. So that didn't go so well. My newfound life of being on the road and being really free. And I thought, this is fabulous. But it's coming to an end. And at our very last show, I was very lucky. I met another man. And he presented me with yet another opportunity to live my free life. We were going to do a hippie commune, and we were going to travel around to festivals and listen to music. And he had this beautiful three-year-old child. I've always wanted to be a mom. I thought that would be awesome, you know. And I thought, well, I can, you know, not be his mom because he already has a mom, but I can stand in and do fun things with him and play with him. And, you know, I mean, I was just in my head, can homeschool once we get on this commune? We'll be responsible drinkers during the week, and then we'll do the extra stuff during the weekends. Had it all planned out. And I was with him 7 days. Or so, maybe 9, I don't remember. But, you know, less than 2 weeks, definitely. And I remember during that time, I started to mentally not be that with it. But I started to constantly, you know, my mind was just spinning. How can I hang on to this way of life? He was telling me if I don't get it together, he's going to leave me. And, you know, and like, you know, this is a group of people that don't even go by their real name. And I'll never be able to find him if I can't shape up. Because I was starting to act really weird. And I didn't know it at the time, but I was going through having a nervous breakdown. Wasn't eating, wasn't sleeping a whole lot, very periods, you know, the depression a little bit, but mostly manic. Would start crying, was blacking out a lot. And, you know, the idea that I was responsible enough to take care of a three-year-old was absolutely ludicrous. And I think I started to see that. And that started to chip away at part of me and just put another crack inside of me. I remember one day, and this was another example of we didn't drink every day. We went to festivals, we didn't have any money. So one day we go to a festival and we're there and I start drinking at like, you know, 8 or 9 in the morning, something early. And I'm walking around with this three-year-old and that's, you know, I don't really remember much else. You know, it's like 10 or 12 o'clock at night and I'm like, where is he? It's like 12 hours difference or something. And he's like, oh, I'll put him to bed. I'm like, oh, that's great, you know, because I have started to drink. I have started to put every substance I can get inside my body and go off and have a good time because that's what I'm all about, having a good time and feeling good. And I get arrested in Pennsylvania because of my nervous breakdown. I was a little crazy. I don't know how else to describe it. And, you know, basically in the wrong place at the wrong time, but really thought I was supposed to be there. And it was evident to everyone else except for me that I was crazy and that something was terribly wrong. I had shaved my head at this time because I thought that was a good idea. This huge nose ring hanging out of my nose. I was probably you know, this number keeps going up, unfortunately, every time I tell this story, but it's probably 30 pounds, you know, less than what I weigh now, maybe even more. Just really, you know, not very attractive, I don't think. And you know, it's interesting because my experience with this and then the story my parents tell me years later after I've been in AA for a while is completely different, of course, because I have been wronged. They're arresting me for absolutely no reason. They're locking me in solitary confinement. They're stripping me of all my rights. Do they know who I am? You know, I am over 18 and, you know, all this stuff, charged with two felonies. And just really at a loss, but still fighting because I am a fighter. And just, you know, I was crazy. I was just a jerk to everyone, of course, and very antisocial with, you know, I was yelling at people, let me out, I don't want your stuff. I shoved all my little belongings outside the cell so you can keep your stuff, except I didn't say it that nicely. And when I got enough attention, because a bunch of people started to come down when I made enough noise, and they were, like, impressed that I could shove everything out underneath the little cell thing. And, you know, they gave me this big thing that looked like a big napkin, and I wore that for a while. And, you know, when you give your stuff away in jail or prison or wherever I was, they don't really give it back to you. So I would sleep with this, I wore this wool blanket. Eventually they gave me my wool blanket. I had no sheets. My mattress, they gave me back my wool blanket, and that was it. You know, no soap, no toothbrush, no toilet paper, no nothing. And I lived like that for, you know, probably 5 or 6 days. And I thought that I was in the secret holding cell because the end of the world was going to come. And that this is where all the people that had tapped into this new spiritual way of life were going to be held. And my dad said to me one day, he said, on the phone, of course, do you know where you are? And I said, yeah. And he said, you're in wherever, jail, prison, Pennsylvania. And I said, yeah, I know that, but I didn't know that. And something inside of me said, oh, what if I really am? What if what I believe isn't really happening? And I got very scared and spent probably for the next, you know, 6 months to a year going just crazy and scared and not trusting anyone and being locked up in Tucker's. That's our lovely institution in Richmond. I have spent time on most every single floor of that place, especially in the where the mentally ill are kept, because I had taken myself there. I did not believe that God punishes people or that was what was happening to me or, you know, a lot of people were trying to help me. It was very clear that there was something wrong with me. And they took me there to get some help, and I got multiple diagnoses. You know, I went 3 times. The last time they told me I was such a bad, bad patient. They said, if you come here again, we're going to have to build you your own special wing because you don't play well with others. And got diagnosed as a codependent the first time, which was great. I was like, oh, sure, I like people to like me. Second time I went in there, I think they diagnosed me as an alcoholic drug addict. I think the third time it was all of that. Plus, they diagnosed me as bipolar 2 disorder. And I got out a very confused person. And I had some exposure to AA in there. And eventually, I went to AA because I had been seeing a professional that said, I think this is what has happened to you. I think you've had a nervous breakdown. If you don't quit drinking and doing drugs for at least a year, you'll never recover. You'll never heal. You're going to be crazy for the rest of your life. And that didn't sound very good. So I was like, sure, I'll quit drinking for a year. I mean, who can't do that, right? Anybody can. So I thought. So then I'd start on my journey of fighting through this, you know, once again, everyone is against me, you know. Pennsylvania, Virginia, my parents, the therapist, they don't understand my new way of life, my spirituality that I've tapped into. And I can't not drink. And the time that I was not drinking was worse than when I was ever drinking mentally. I was depressed. I had to lie while I laid in bed all day long because I was so embarrassed that I didn't want to get up. I was very unemployable. Just really hopeless. And I remember I signed up for this. I was going to take a pottery class because I thought, well, that's a good way to get out of myself you know, just get out of the house, do something where, you know, if you don't show up, you know, it's not like they're going to fire you. And I got drunk the night before and couldn't go. And I was devastated. I thought, it's months of being depressed and not going out and having nothing to do. And this was my one little outlet. I was going to go explore and just devastated. You know, they talk about in the big book, we proceed to drink again. Why do we do it? We feel hopeless the next morning. All that despair shows up. I'm never going to get any better, and I want to kill myself. And I called a woman, and I called two women in AA. One, I forgot to leave my number, so she didn't call me back. The second one said, if you are a hopeless alcoholic, you are going to die if you don't come and start living this way of life. I was like, she sounds a little dramatic. I'm not calling her back. And so I said, I don't need AA, and I don't need what, you know, these people can't tell me what to do. You know, nobody tells me what to do. I live my own life. And 7 days later, I went to my first AA meeting. I didn't relate to a thing the guy said. He was a guy, and he had a completely different life. But there was something in me that I was compelled to pick up a white chip. I didn't even know what it meant. And I remember afterwards I was attacked by all these people because I hated all of you, you know. Not hate, just the people, you know. They were coming at me, they were trying to touch me and hug me and congratulate me. And the women, they were like giving me phone numbers. And I have space that's like this huge space. And they were entering it in flocks. And I thought, good God, I cannot get out of here fast enough. And I did not feel like I arrived, nonetheless. I mean, a lot of people do when they come here, and I think that's awesome. That was not me. And so, but I did, you know, for some reason I went out to breakfast with these guys. They were, probably because I like men better than women, they were some older gentlemen that were very nice and invited me out to breakfast. And I went with them, and I started coming back. You know, I don't know why, it didn't make sense. I didn't know what I was doing here. I started to come back and hang out with you people. And I identified enough that I kept coming back. And I didn't drink when I came back. I hung out with you guys, and I got a little bit better. But I didn't form relationships with women, which if you're new or not new, because it took me a long time to do that, I would suggest that. It has been paramount in my recovery to be connected to you people, to be in a fellowship of women, to be honest with people, for people to know where I am. And I spent about a year in AA not doing that. I hung out with the boys, and that was about it. I practiced my dating skills, which I had none. So those were all disasters. And eventually, living like that, which is untreated alcoholism in my book, showing up at a meeting is not the solution that I need. It is one piece of the triangle. Because I do have to be connected to you people, but I've got to be doing the other two sides, or else I will never recover. And that's for me. I am the alcoholic that they talk about in the big book, and I will not recover on a part of the solution. I relate a lot to when they talk about there's no middle of the road solution. That was me. So my middle of the road solution was resulting in nothing but me hitting another bottom, basically. My experience has been not drinking, but trying to live life. I am more hopeless. I just don't have, I don't know, I didn't get the manual. You know, my parents certainly tried to show me the manual on how you live and have a respectable life and treat people with dignity. And I, you know, I don't know. It just didn't seep in. So I hit my bottom. And, you know, I was talking to a woman on Saturday, and I don't know whether she's one of us. She may belong in another fellowship. And she came to a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I talked to her after the meeting, and I said, you know, this is not meant to say that, you know, we don't want you here or that anything like that. This is about you finding your truth. Because if you do not find your truth, I'm afraid that you may not make it. I said, because that was my experience. I was walking around in AA not knowing whether, do I really have bipolar 2 disorder? You know, if I do, great. There's help for that. I mean, there's medication, there's therapy, yada, yada, yada. Am I really a drug addict? I don't know. I did a lot of drugs. I don't know what that looks like. Am I really an alcoholic? You know, I identify with you guys enough, but not all the way. So I still had that resolve. Not resolve, but, you know, distance from you guys. I called myself an alcoholic, but didn't really believe that. And, you know, as I was talking to her Saturday, I said, you know, one of the things that saved my life is that someone reached out their hand and offered to meet me where I was, not where I needed to be or where they thought I should be, but where I was, and said, let me help you figure out whether you belong here, because I was going to drink or blow my brains out at that point. At least that's what I thought. That's pretty dramatic, but that's what I was feeling. And I tend to be pretty dramatic, so. And, you know, sharing with her, I said, you know, that was so important to me because those guys I was running with, one of them died 2 years later of a heroin overdose, and the other one I haven't seen since. And I believe, and I don't know if this is true or not, just my belief, that if I hadn't have tapped into what I tapped into and at that crossroads in the path going this way instead of that way, I think I would be dead. I think I would have been running with him again and going to festivals and doing what people do there. And I didn't. I think that there was a teeny bit of me that was willing to find out the truth. And so I started on a journey with her, and I'm still on that journey with her. And I've taken that journey with many other women that I sponsor and many of my friends in AA. And it is one of recovery. It is one of being in the middle of AA. I do not believe that I could be on the outside of AA. And it took me a long time. I mean, it really, to feel connected, I guess. That's been one of the things that did not come naturally to me. I have a girlfriend that we got sober about the same time, and she just, for some reason, that was part of her life that she was willing to surrender right away. She was willing to get connected with women and hang out and get to know you and whatever girls do, things, and I was just so closed up inside, and I was willing to show up and take the steps and be of service, but I had a really hard time connecting, and it took me years, and it was all me. I mean, it was the fear, it was the, you know, I think I know how to manage my life crap that keep coming up and again and again and again, and, because it's interesting, I shared this Friday night at a meeting I spoke at that I have, for the last couple of weeks, there have been a lot of women that have been coming to me and talking to me about their experience and feeling on the outside. And that, you know, they can show up somewhere and they'll go, oh, these people don't like me. No one likes me here. And leave quickly after a meeting. And anyway, I felt like that for a long time. And it is a result of showing up and not stopping. You know, those cheesy little sayings they have, don't stop 2 minutes before the miracle or whatever they say. I used to think they were all so cheesy. That really is true. And it has been my experience today. If I will just show up and do what you people ask of me, that I will recover. But I'm not going to recover on my time. I'm going to recover on God's time. I used to spend a lot of mental energies thinking about step 6. Is it that I'm not really willing to let this go, or is it that it's useful to God? And I used to debate that, like, oh, this is so interesting to think about. Well, that's exhausting, and I have not found that any fruit has come of that. It's been worthless time spent, really. You know, because I don't know what the truth is. I really don't. I don't know what the truth is anymore today for me on how to manage and run my life than I did when I was drinking. What I do know, or what I have experienced with today, is a solution. And I don't try to manage and control my life. I don't try to not drink today. I don't have that power anymore back then than I do today. What I do is I do spiritual exercises every single day. I took the steps. I continue to take those. I sponsor women. I show up at meetings. I have service commitments. I spend my time helping other people when that is presented to me. I pray. I have had a spiritual awakening as a result of with me being connected with my Creator. And I continue to, you know, just be on the journey, learning and changing and growing. Is not an overnight matter. And I really thought the first time I went through the steps, I was under this delusion that once I did them, I would be perfect. And I would be just totally connected with you people and, you know, selfless, and I wouldn't have any bumps along the road that basically like popping a pill and drinking some alcohol. I would be in this la-la land and everything would be just fantastic. And, you know, that's not been my experience. It's been, me growing up has been very painful. I got to look at stuff that I believe and ask, is that true or not? I got to be willing to let go of fears and for God to take me to a better place. I got to help people when it's inconvenient to me. And a lot of things have been inconvenient because I'm so selfish. After about, you know, a time, however long that was, I started to be employable again. I started to, I got in a relationship with this guy, and I went back to school, and, you know, I'm busy. And I don't have time to help you people because I've got things to do. And luckily, if you go through the steps and you have a sponsor, it is pounded into your head that you must be of service to other alcoholics or you will not fully recover here. And some of those people drink again, some of those people don't, but recovery does not come from me worrying about me. And I took those actions only because it had been pounded into my head, not because I believed it or cared or whatever. I just did it because I had to do it, I thought. And it's just like anything else. If I will just take the action, then something changes in me. It's great joy today to work with other women. I'm compelled to go help people. It was not a something that I came to naturally. And I shared this Friday night, too. I used to, when a new woman would come up to me, I would go, you should really go talk to this person because they've got more sobriety. You know, they know more than me. I'm only a couple years sober. I know nothing, you know. But really just ignorant, really, that this is about being in the spirit. This is not about me intellectualizing that they have more sobriety than me or anything like that. You know, this woman is coming to me. If God wanted her to go over there, then he'd send her over there, you know. So I had to have a lot of experience with that and just really trust that I have awoken, that I am on a path, and I can share that experience with someone, and that I have a connection with a creator, and that's who I pray to for direction when I work with women. And I have a sponsor, and I talk to her a lot. And I've made lots of mistakes with sponsoring women, you know, the lectures that we give, because we do incredible, absurd things when we're new and when we're drinking, and, you know, when you haven't done any of those for a while, like drink yourself into a coma or something, you know. We're like, why would you do that? Well, I did the same thing. Why would I do that? You know, because we're powerless, because we're drunks. That's what we do. That's what I'd be doing tonight if I wasn't here with you and I wasn't in the middle of AA. So I've gotten to learn a lot about how it's really just about me sharing my experience, me being willing, and the results are in God's hands. I have a home group that I'm a part of, and I started a couple years ago out in Ashland. We meet at 9 a.m. on Saturday morning, and we're a big book study. We do the last Saturday of the month, we do a tradition, and then we have a home group meeting. And we say a lot of prayers there, the beginning and end, so that we all love each other before and after. Because there are some differences in between. And it's been a really great place for me to grow. I spent the first 5 years or so of my recovery in a really strong, humongous home group, super active and carrying the message to other alcoholics, and grew up a ton there. Learned things like showing up early for the meeting, staying seated during the meeting, not talking during the meeting, staying afterwards to help clean up. Things I had no comprehension of. Because I spent the first year in AA talking, getting up. I mean, I would leave most of the meeting to go smoke cigarettes and hang out with the boys in the parking lot. Just really not concerned that people are here to get better. Concerned with me and what I need. And so I spent a good chunk of time growing up there, and I didn't want to leave, and I got led after I started this meeting to change home groups. And it was really a decision where can I be of most service. Because I really want it, because I am comfortable here with these 50 people that know me. They're my family. I've grown up here. I know what to do here. Why are you making me leave? That's how I felt. And I had to write some inventory because I had some fear and anger. And I went over here with these three people that do things differently than I had been brought up in AA. You know, not that they're not doing AA, but just a little differently. And I got my ideas about how things should be done. And so I got to have yet again another experience of being useful. I had like 5 service commitments at one time during, you know, and I was busy. And I felt overwhelmed a lot, and I had to pray for God to help me keep my commitments and to be where I was. And it was a good place for me to let go of what I think you're supposed to be doing. Because I don't know what you're supposed to be doing. I know what I'm supposed to be doing. And that's because I asked my sponsor, and she tells me. So I got to let the group be what it is, to let people have their own experiences, and to learn how to be effective in carrying a message that has saved my life without judging what has saved yours. And that is not something that comes naturally to me, because I do think that I'm right and you're wrong. So I got some, and I'm still learning this. I'm by no means a completely tolerant person. But I got to learn some tolerance and love of other people. And it talks about in the big book, one of the most useful things that we can have as people carrying the message is tolerance of other people's viewpoints and shortcomings. I remember talking to my friend one day. She's like, brought that up. I was like, you know, didn't have anything nice in my head going on when she was saying that. I was like, yeah, but you don't understand. But it's the truth, you know. I have found more peace and more ability to share and help people by coming at them that way than coming at them on the spiritual hilltop of I know how AA works and let me show you how AA works. So, you know, that's kind of where I am in that. I was very excited. Etta was with me on Saturday. We had a home group meeting. I have 1 service commitment now, and I'm very excited about that because I get to be the GSR now. I was the alternate, and I want to be able to do that job the best that I can do it. And I was feeling a little overwhelmed because I was also doing a bunch of other things. And anyway, it was just neat to see the Spirit of God move when I get out of the way. And other people got what they needed to do, and we're growing and changing, and we're carrying the message. And that's what it's all about for me today. And real quickly, it's time for me to share. But, you know, I will say that God has changed me in, you know, every single area of my life. I'm now married today. I am now, I'm a productive member of my community. I'm able to show up and be of service there. And I learned that by being in AA, to show up early. You know, to keep my mouth shut unless someone asks me for my opinion or experience. So I get to do that in my community. I get to do that in my home life. I get to do that at work. And just, you know, being restored to sanity and having a life that makes sense to me and being useful. Those are things I never would have thought would make me feel whole. But that's what they have done for me. And with that, I'll close. Thank you.